Welcome to The Reserve, a news and thoughts podcast from the Central Verse. I'm your host, Caleb Nygaard, and today is episode number 44. I am delighted and honored to have Chief Economics Commentator and Deputy Economics Editor at The Wall Street Journal, the one and only Greg Ipp, on the show today. Greg, thanks for coming on.
Hey, Caleb, thanks a lot for having me on the podcast.
Absolutely. It is an exciting week in the Central Verse, in the Fed world. But it seems like we could say that for the whole year, the last maybe couple of years.
That's for sure.
And so that's actually one of the things, that's what we're going to kind of do today. We want to spend just a few minutes at the top and get your take, which I know you have a piece on out this morning, which I will link to in the show notes. But I want to get a real quick recap of your takeaways from the FOMC meeting and presser this week. And then we'll talk a little about the biggest stories of 2022 and what that kind of tells us about the Fed. So I just want to start there. Tell me kind of what you got out of the meeting. Were there any surprises? Was it just what you expected?
Well, there's an old saying in Fed watching, Caleb, which is that what the Fed says is often more important than what it does. And that was definitely the case this week. So the Fed raised its key interest rate target by half a percentage point, but they had telegraphed that so well that it came as no surprise whatsoever. The surprise came in all the sort of the projections and discussion that came out around that. So let's talk about the projections. Every 3 months, Fed officials release their best guess on where things like interest rates, inflation, and the economy are going. And the projections this time around came as somewhat of a hawkish surprise. What do I mean by that? Well, they tell us that they think that interest rates could climb as high as 5.1% by the end of next year, which is a full half percentage point higher than they told us 3 months ago. And it's also somewhat higher than markets have been betting on. They also think the economy is going to grow much more slowly next year, only half a percent compared to the 1.2% they thought 3 months ago. Unemployment will be higher than they thought. And perhaps most disturbing, they think inflation will also be higher. So the core inflation rate, the one that excludes the volatile food and energy categories, they think it'll be 3.5% a year from now. They thought 3 months ago that would only be 3.1%. So you take that all together, Caleb, and that's a real kind of like hawkish mixture. Not only are they projecting that interest rates will be higher than people were betting on and that the economy as a result will be weaker, but it's not even producing what those sorts of things are supposed to produce, which is to say lower inflation. And I think the overall picture, and this was kind of like backed up by Chair Jerry Powell's rhetoric in the subsequent press conference, is of a central bank that's quite a bit more pessimistic about the path for inflation and therefore the work the Fed has to do in terms of interest rates to get it down than the markets have been. And that's sort of a recipe for like a bad day or two in the markets, which as we speak today on Thursday is exactly what's going on.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, I think that was, it was, and that's been the case at each of these SEPs. And I do have to ask, do you call it the SEP or do you call it the SEPs? Yesterday, I heard somebody in two people at the presser called it the SEPs. I don't remember having heard that before.
Caleb, I'm afraid you've asked me a question I've never asked myself before. I think I just sort of like say this to myself all the time, and I don't think I've ever actually had. I just call it the projections. I try to talk like an ordinary human being,
I was,
like a Fed head.
I appreciate that. Yeah, when I heard the SEPs, and I don't know which is worse, SEPs or SEP, but they're well, both.
Sepsis sounds like something that you go to the hospital for, like a deadly infection, right?
It does. That's it. Yes, yeah, that or some kind of sewage treatment thing. And it's not good. It's not good either way. But this projections, which I like that word. They did it again, right? There was a couple of pieces. I think Gina at the time and Rachel at the Post had pieces out, kind of showing that, you know, it's just showing like how much. Each time at each of the four projections that were released this year, they, you know, increased the numbers or decreased the numbers in exactly the direction that you're saying. We're going to talk a little about those earlier ones. But speaking of yesterday and this kind of pessimistic turn, maybe, you know, what does it mean for how the Fed is thinking about inflation for next year? Is it just as simple as a sign that it's worse than they thought it was, or is it that they're tools aren't going to work as well as they thought they were going to work. How do you think they're thinking about this on a broader perspective?
Well, Powell helped us out by sort of like breaking down inflation into three components. There's durable goods. Well, first of all, take out the food and energy part, which tends to be very volatile. Now, importantly, those were both going up a lot at the first part of the year. Now they're coming down a lot, partly because some of the strains related to the Russian invasion of Ukraine have subsided. Set those aside, that leaves us with core inflation. He divided that into three pieces. There's goods, there's shelter, and there's services other than shelter. Yeah. So on goods, what we've seen is a lot of deflation, actually. Prices of used cars, for example, coming down, which was something we've been anticipating for a while because they've been pushed up so high by these pandemic-related supply chains snarls. And that's good news, and it's bringing the inflation rate down. But the important thing Powell tells us is that doesn't really tell us a lot about what the underlying path of inflation is going to be. What about shelter? Shelter matters because it's the largest component of the consumer price index. I think it's something like 15 or 20%. So shelter has this huge influence on the overall inflation rate. And that number has been very high lately because essentially the way the Labor Department measures the shelter component, it basically looks at new leases, new rents, and so forth, makes a calculation about what that means for what the average family is paying for housing. And that tends to have a lot of inertia in it. And it's very high right now, but we know that in a year's time, based on what we're seeing, it's going to go down. Yeah. What Powell said is, let's set those two things aside because they're not really telling us what's going on in the underlying dynamics of inflation, which is really about supply and demand.
Yeah.
You know, there's the old George Bernard Shaw line, right? That if you want to yield an economist, just teach a parrot to say supply and demand over and over again. And that's what it is with inflation, Caleb. It's supply and demand, the ability to supply goods and services and the demand for goods and services. And the reason that Powell is focusing on these services prices is because they tend to be very sticky. They don't move around a lot. Once they start going up, they tend to keep going up. And the biggest driver of them is labor. That's the biggest component of things like, you know, hotel stays or like restaurant meals or hospitals and healthcare. And so when he looks at non-shelter services, he asks himself, what does that tell us about what the labor market is doing? And then he goes and looks at the labor market and he says, what does that say about the path for inflation? And he looks at the labor market and he sees a job market that seems just as strong and powerful and overheated as it was 10 months ago when the Fed started raising interest rates. So the bottom line is, Powell says, I get it that you're optimistic about shelter. I get it that you're optimistic about energy and food. And I get it that you're optimistic about the fact that goods like cars are coming down. But none of that tells us really where inflation will be a year or two from now. For that, you need to look at the labor market. And he doesn't like what he sees there. And so that, more than anything, I think, Caleb, explains why he came out with so much more of a sort of pessimistic view on where inflation is going than where the markets have been.
Yeah. Excellent, excellent breakdown of that situation and that press conference. Now, so what is it that they're going to be looking at in the next couple of meetings? It seems there's often these paths that we get on where it becomes quite predictable. Even, you know, since the summer, basically, we've been on these, you know, even though they're historically huge interest rates and they're a really big deal, that's the direction that we've been going. I feel like we're entering now into another period of maybe a little bit of uncertainty. And it seemed to me to come through again, this is the kind of the second press conference that at least, if not a few more, where Powell has emphasized, you know, it's not necessarily, you know, how fast we raise interest, but it's where we land. And we're now coming, we're like that landing spot is within reach possibly. Like we're now not a year, you know, we're, unless something goes terribly wrong, we're not going to still be raising interest rates in a year from now. And so we're coming closer to that point where those decisions are going to have to be made. And how do you think the Fed is looking at that? Or what do we know as to what the Fed will be looking for into the next months? Is it the like you said, the labor reports, monthly labor reports? What are some things that they're going to be looking for?
Well, as you said, I think it's, as Powell has now told us a few times, with respect to interest rates, it's not the journey, it's the destination and how long you stay at that destination, right? He's told us now with no ambiguity. Stop obsessing over whether we do 25, 50, or 75. The key issue is where do rates end up? And that was one of the reasons yesterday's meeting was a little bit on the hawkish side, because even though they only did 50 instead of 75, like at the last four meetings, the endpoint ended up higher, and they expect to be high for longer. They're still at 4% 2 years from now. Now, that still leaves a lot of room for deciding, well, do they actually intend to stick with that peak rate of 5.1%? Do they stop before that? Do they stop after that? And how many months do they stay there? And you appropriately asked, what are the data points that will determine that question? Now, if you'd asked me that, like if we had done this podcast a month or 2 months or 3 months ago, my answer would have been, we're looking at the inflation numbers, because Powell kept saying we need to see several months of really constructive decelerating inflation pressure before we know that we're ready to pivot to lower or ready to pause. That's not the message this week. So the answer is now different.
Yeah.
As I was saying a moment ago, he is really laser focused on the labor market as the prime directive of where inflation is going. So if I could tell you there was only one number I cared about in the next 2 months to determine what the Fed would do, it is the wage number that comes out with the monthly employment report, because it's the most complete and the most timely data we have about just how this tightness in the labor market is manifesting itself in terms of the labor costs. What else would I look at? I would look at the vacancy numbers, which come out in both the official and a few private surveys. I would look at some of the other wage data, like, for example, the quarterly employment cost index. Broadly speaking, Caleb, I would be looking at that whole mass of data that tells us whether the labor market is starting to become a little less overheated and pointing to an endpoint where wages are not at their current level, which the Fed is quite clear is not consistent with their 2% inflation target.
Okay, so let's talk about kind of this year, 2022. I think that you know, 2020 was obviously an important year for the central bank doing all sorts of crisis fighting stuff. But 2022, I think, is going to be another one that when we look back to tell the story of the central bank, it'll be a very important one. And I want to start with the leadership. There's been turnover that, you know, it's hard to believe, but we were debating whether Powell or not would even be in the chair position in the early part of the year. So I just want to kind of leave it open to you to talk about the Powell or the FOMC more broadly. There's been a lot of changes. How do you see the committee dynamics, and how have you seen that change this year? And what do you think are the important points?
So sure, let's talk about personnel then. As you say, so the guy at the top has been the same. President Biden, about 1 year ago, reappointed Jay Powell to another 4 years as chairman of the Federal Reserve. And I think that reflects a couple of things. First of all, although Powell is a Republican who was appointed by Donald Trump, he has shown a very kind of technocratic, nonpartisan approach to making monetary policy. And in particular, prior to early 2021, he had shown an enormous degree of concern about the labor market, which is, you know, a focus that you normally associate with sort of Democratic rather than Republican policymakers. And so in some sense, from a policy point of view, it was an easy call for Biden to make. I think also it sort of like showed that I think Biden is kind of an institutionalist. He liked the idea of like reappointing the Fed chairman, irrespective of his party identification, because that's historically what institutional Washington does and likes. And finally, Biden knew that he had a lot of opportunities to fill other spots on the Fed if he wanted to put a more of a personal stamp on that. And he has, in fact, done that. So Lael Brainard, who is a very well-regarded former Democratic policymaker, PhD economist, she had been a governor on the Board of Governors. She has been elevated to vice chairman of the Fed, which is the second most powerful position. That's very important.
Yeah.
He filled two other spots with Phil Jefferson and Lisa Cook, two African-American members of the Board of Governors. It's important, I think, for like signaling attention to diversity and inclusion on the system and making sure that our institutions look like America. What can we learn from those appointments? Well, you know, I think that in the early going, and my expectation was that Biden would appoint people who are probably of a dovish inclination, because what president doesn't want a Federal Reserve
that's
dovish and isn't going to like ruin your reelection chances, right? And I think one of the interesting takeaways is that it's very hard to actually see what these individuals have done and sort of conclude that this was a particularly dovish set of individuals. You know, I've read the speeches that these individuals have given, and they're almost impossible to distinguish from the speeches that Jay Powell has been giving.
Sure.
I suspect that reflects a couple of things. And first of all, when you're a central banker and inflation is like 8%, your target is 2%, you don't need to think a lot about what your priority ought to be, right? It's like get the darn inflation rate down. Yep. And that comes through very clearly in the speeches that these individuals have been giving. The second point is that, you know, irrespective of what your background is, when you walk, you take that oath of office and you sit down in the hallowed halls, you know, of the Martin Building of the Federal Reserve down in Washington, D.C. on Constitution Avenue, you become a central banker.
Yeah.
And you sort of really do set aside a lot of those, you know, whatever partisan inclinations you had. And that too comes through in the remarks that you see from all these individuals. The person I do think is perhaps most interesting to watch is Leah Brainerd, because in some sense, not only has she got the longest history of an individual there, and so you can sort of watch the evolution of her views, but she's also the kind of person people think about as being taking Powell's place as chairman if Powell is not reappointed to a third term in a few years' time, which I think is probably most people's expectation.
Yeah.
And I have detected, at least in the last few months, a little bit of a dovish tilt in what she says, in the sense that she, I think more so than Powell, has talked a bit more about the fact that when you raise interest rates, the effect on the economy is seen only with a lag.
Yeah.
So you need to be careful about not tightening too much and discovering the damage was greater than you expected. Yeah. That's kind of like a dovish way of talking. I haven't noticed that on the part of the others, but I think that's an interesting kind of dynamic to watch. Then, of course, as you know, around the board of governors, there's 12 Reserve Bank presidents. A few of them have been replaced this year. And I'm not really sure what to make of that. You know, for example, Susan Collins, who has been appointed. You know what? I actually just forgot. There's another individual who's appointed to the board of governors. I totally forgot about him. Michael Barr. He is the reason I didn't think about him is he is the governor in charge of regulation. So he's not the kind of person you actually think about first in terms of where's policy going.
That's right.
But, you know, I've known Michael Barr from his previous appointments. He's a very thoughtful policymaker. I'll be very interested to hear what he has to say on monetary policy matters as well. When you look at the presidents, the 12 Reserve Bank presidents, what do we see there? Susan Collins has been appointed president of the Reserve Bank of Boston. She's a very well-regarded academic economist. You know, I detect a little bit of that sort of like dovishness in some of her public remarks, a great attention to the labor market. Haven't detected it in anything she does policy-wise. Austin Goolsbee has been announced, hasn't yet taken office, but he will be the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. And Caleb, here's a little bit of advice. Try and get him on your show. Because Austin, other than being a first-rate economist, is just a hilarious, wonderful speaker. You know, he's like a debating champion, does stand-up comedy. I suspect he'll have to rein in some of the spontaneity now that he's like a very serious central banker. But, you know,
I'll have to get him on a non-voting year. Maybe I can get him on a non-voting year.
Yeah, that's right. When he knows that nobody will be listening because who, you know.
That's right. Right.
Yeah. No, I suspect he won't be letting his guard down too much. But my point is that Austin is a very sort of centrist individual. He did work for Barack Obama. So, you know, he's a Democrat. But I suspect you'll see that it's a very sort of like centrist individual.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, it has been a lot. There has been a lot of changes, and I think that your comments on Vice Chair Brainerd are particularly succinct. And it'll be interesting to see as the politics. I think most agree that she's a little bit tied closer to the politics, and this is not her last job. And so whether something opens at Treasury or something, basically the top job, I think, is the only thing she'd take. And then maybe if Biden's gets in or whoever the Democrat ends up being gets elected, then she's definitely a candidate for chair. So important settling in here. Although Cook will come up for renomination next year. Although now that the Senate is fully in the hands of the Democrats, I suspect that'll go pretty smooth. So let's move on then. Just for the next couple of minutes, talk to me about these changes. We talked about briefly every projection that they did for this year, and each time they kind of re-upped their estimate, and you look back just to the to the March ones, much less the ones from December of last year, and there's been some big changes. Talk to me about about what happened here. And it wasn't just the Fed. I think the Fed has been largely in line with a lot of private sector forecasts. But talk to me about, you know, how the Fed's viewing inflation itself, the different theories, the different ways that they're looking at this, and how that changed over 2022.
You know, Caleb, I think the best way to think about this is the theory that the Fed had about what the economy would look like coming out of the pandemic and how reality ended up being not at all like that theory. So cast your mind back to the, middle of 2020. We were just a few months into the pandemic. Unemployment was double digits. Everybody was extremely pessimistic about the economy. The price of oil had briefly traded in negative territory, and the inflation rate was below 1%. And the Fed, like most of us, thought that the economy coming out of the pandemic would look a lot like the economy coming out of the Great Recession in 2007 to 2009, which is to say high and prolonged unemployment, like soft, restrained demand, people unwilling to spend, focused on like they're repairing their balance sheets, a slow, sluggish recovery, inflation that was persistently too low rather than too high, not making it back to their 2% target. And so based on their experience of the too slow recovery from the prior recession, they said, let's take a different approach to policy now. Let's have a new framework. And this framework is going to say, hey, we're a dual mandate central bank. We're supposed to care about full employment, not just low inflation. We're going to actually set our policy goals now to make sure that full employment is taken care of before we start pivoting back to inflation. Because we learned that if you react too soon to inflation, you basically forestall the recovery in employment, and that's bad for a lot of people, including the most disadvantaged people in the workforce. So they rolled out what came to be called the new framework in the summer of 2020, which basically said, we're going to actually aim for inflation above 2% to make up for all those years of inflation below 2%. And we're going to operationalize this new framework by not raising interest rates from around zero until inflation is at 2% or higher, and we're back to full employment, which is basically an unemployment rate of 4% or lower. That's very different from prior cycles where the Fed would be forward looking and say, well, even though we're not at full employment now, we will be in a few years from now, so we better start raising interest rates now. It was basically a commitment to deliberately allow inflation to overshoot. But yeah, it was a commitment that was totally designed for a set of circumstances that turned out not to be true at all for the post-pandemic economy. And again, I don't want to be too rough on them because this is a mistake almost everybody made.
Yeah.
But coming out of the pandemic economy, demand came back way faster than anybody expected. You know, as restrictions were dropped and lockouts were ended, people came back. It turned out that they weren't going to like just stay at home all the time because of the virus. The federal government, Congress, pumped, what was it, $4 trillion of stimulus into the economy between 2020 and 2021. Stock prices, housing prices had shot up like rockets, so everybody felt wealthy.
And yeah,
this created this iceberg of demand trying to like fit into an economy where supply was really constrained. Because, for example, we'd lost a lot of workers to the virus. People didn't want to work. There'd been a lot of shutdowns. People had bought a lot of goods when they were like locked down, things like, you know, cars and game consoles and whatever. And so our supply chains were all screwed up. The consequence of jamming all this demand, which had been designed with like a 2009 type scenario in mind, hitting a supply strained economy was for inflation to take off.
Yeah.
Now, for the first few months of that, the Fed, again, like I would say most private economists, thought this would be transitory. They thought that there would be some wrinkles to work out while the people got back to, post-pandemic normalcy, and then prices would come back. And that didn't happen. And it didn't happen for many months. And the Fed kept saying, well, we have this commitment. We have this commitment that we're not going to raise rates until inflation is back to or above its target, until we're back to full employment. And as a result, they were very slow to start raising interest rates. They were even just as slow to stop quantitative easing. So I would say that what happened was the Fed essentially made a mistake like everybody else in thinking that the inflation problem would be the same as it was 10 years earlier, and when in fact it wasn't. But then they compounded that with a second mistake, which they have only themselves to blame. And that was waiting many months before starting to actually tighten monetary policy and ending quantitative easing, and therefore getting behind the eight ball. A lot of what you see in 2022 is trying to fix the errors of 2021. by raising interest rates at this unprecedented rate, or at least, you know, the highest we've seen since the 80s, in some sense, to make up the ground that they should have been covering a year earlier. So one thing I'd like to say is that if you actually watch what Powell's been doing and saying for the last few months, including the fact that he's so much more hawkish than the markets, part of it could be read as him, in sense, was trying to compensate from those mistakes of a year ago. I think what he wants to do is eradicate any suspicion that the mistakes of a year ago were, in some sense, because they were ideologically unwilling or unprepared to deal with inflation. Those were forecasting mistakes, and he is saying we're not going to make those again. And just to make it clear to everybody that we care as much as we ever do about inflation, we're going to err on the other side. I think that's probably one way you could actually read the nature of his press conference this week, and indeed many of the speeches he's been giving for the last few months.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think that that came through in many moments, but possibly nowhere more clear than the almost physical reaction that you could see in Powell's, in his body language, responding to the question about considering raising his, or discussing raising the inflation target. You could just see those, just like over my dead body. I need to project just that is absolutely the, you know, we're not, to kind of use a thing that he used to say, we're not going to think about thinking about, you know, about doing that.
I think
that's exactly right. Okay. The scandal, the series of scandals, as I like to say, because I think a lot of people will think of these scandals as just being one big thing, but there were a lot of small, from trading scandals to speaking scandals to, there's just been, seemed to have been, you know, that about 8 month period from the fall of 2021 through the late spring, early summer, there seemed to be a lot of news about kind of misbehavior, resignations and stuff. So not talking about any of the specific cases per se, but I just wondering how you think that has, if at all, that has had an impact on the Fed's credibility, either with the public or with Congress, or just how you think about that in like a kind of in a bigger picture it didn't seem to impact the nominations, although it came up. But just how you think about the scandal now that we're at least if we're a little bit removed from it.
So I think the first thing that they told us is that these controversies tell us is that the Fed, in some sense, what we learned was very slow to realize how the world had changed, which is that standards of behavior that were entirely acceptable and normal 10 or 20 years ago no longer are. I mean, it's quite telling that as best as we can tell, none of the reserve banks or governors whose trading activity turned out to be so controversial, as best as we can tell, did not break any of the Fed's own rules or laws. And yet they look really bad. It looked like that they were, trading in markets that were directly influenced by their own actions. Sometimes, while they were in possession of important information the public did not have. And so there was clearly a gap here between the rules and processes in place at the Fed and the and what you would do if you cared about the public's perception of your fidelity to being basically like good public servants. So I think that is probably the main takeaway, that institutionally, the Federal Reserve System was really, really caught behind the eight ball behind all these sorts of things. Whether this has had a lasting impact on the credibility of the Fed or its reputation, it's a good question, Caleb, but I don't know really how you measure it.
Yeah.
As you say, we didn't actually see those things interfere with the appointment of any of these particular individuals. There were certainly some legislators who made a big deal of it. Elizabeth Warren on the Democratic side, signaled a deep displeasure with Chair Jerome Powell. For what it's worth, Powell, I think, was very quick to promulgate a new set of restrictive guidelines that would have not allowed those particular activities to have occurred, or at least would have ought to have flagged them higher. The more interesting question, I think, going forward is how does the Fed try and carry out the many policy duties that it's been asked to carry out while avoiding these reputational and political landmines? I'll give you a very simple example. Climate, right? Now, for one side of the House, for one political party, this is a really big deal, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of Democrats want the Fed to do what they can to hasten the country's progress to net zero. For example, using its supervisory guidance over banks to tell them to pull back on lending to fossil fuel companies. Republicans hate that idea.
Yeah.
If you're the Federal Reserve, what do you do about that? You better have a good answer that satisfies both sides of the aisle. And sometimes that answer is just not available.
Yeah.
And so I think it just raises a lot of challenges. I think if you, it's one of the reasons why Powell, first of all, understands the importance of getting it right on the inflation front, because if you blow it on the one thing that everybody agrees the Fed should be responsible for, you just do untold damage to the credibility of the institution going forward. And that is why he has repeatedly told us he would much rather err on the side of doing too much than doing too little. I think it makes for some interesting discussions between him and his new colleagues on the Board of Governors. What is our position going to be on, for example, climate? What is our position going to be on diversity and equity and so forth? And what role will those factors play in how we target interest rates? You're going to have a central bank that's going to be much more attentive to those things. In some sense, we talked, I think, a little while ago about the makeup of the board and how governors that you thought would be dovish have sounded just as hawkish as everybody else. But like I said, it's easy to do that when the inflation rate's 8%.
Yeah.
A much more interesting question is going to be, when not only the inflation rate is 8%, but the unemployment rate is 3.5%. I mean, that's a pretty low unemployment rate. That's a pretty high inflation rate. It's, it doesn't take a rocket scientist or a PhD economist to know which mandate the Fed should be worried about right now. Well, what about a year and a half from now when, let's say, the inflation rate is 3% and the unemployment rate is 5%? That's a much tougher call. And that's where I think some of these ideological divisions that might be latent in the backgrounds of some of these individuals come to the fore. And you'll have a Federal Open Market Committee that might be more divided, more cacophonous, and more sort of caught in the broader political controversies of the day than you do today. I mean, it was interesting that yesterday's the rate decision that they had this week was unanimous.
Yeah.
And when we talked a bit about the 5.1% peak interest rate in their forecasts, 17 of 19 committee members are calling for that, for a peak rate of 5% or higher. That's a remarkable degree of unanimity.
Yeah.
I would be surprised if that unanimity persists a year from now.
Yeah, agreed. Okay, final question. Looking back at 2022, what we haven't talked about, what stories, it can be as brief or as long as you'd like, but what are some stories that you think either were overlooked or undervalued or will be important going forward?
So I would say that one of the interesting things about 2022 was the dog that didn't bark. We didn't have a financial crisis. Now, not having a crisis isn't typically the sort of thing that makes headlines. But if you had told me a year ago that given the ridiculous speculation we saw on things like meme stocks and cryptocurrencies, the extreme levels of overvaluation in real estate and stocks and bonds and so forth. And starting from that, we were then going to have the fastest rise in interest rates since the early 1980s, and there would be no crisis.
Yeah.
I would have said that doesn't sound likely. And yet here we are. And so we're not going to probably have a lot of PhD theses written about that, but I think it is encouraging that hasn't happened. Now, just watch. Something next week's going to blow up. And you and I will have to have a second podcast to talk about that. But right now, I'd say the fact that we did not have a financial crisis is in some sense encouraging. Well, it's more than just encouraging, but it's very encouraging.
Yeah.
Okay, what's the second thing? I would say that fiscal policy rather than monetary policy is going to be very important to watch going forward. Yeah. In fact, just as we had no crisis in the financial markets, we have seen actually some troubling signs of things in the government bond market being a little bit scary.
Yeah.
You probably remember when the new British government came in a few months ago and they announced they were going to have these tax cuts, and there was basically a rebellion in the bond market, right?
Yeah.
And the prime minister, she didn't even outlast a head of lettuce, the tax cuts were quickly dropped and so forth. I think that gave us a taste of what the world is going to be like for fiscal policy in the next few years versus the prior 10 years. In the post-crisis decade, when inflation was always too low and demand was already too weak, it was open season for fiscal expansion. You could borrow a lot because essentially the world didn't care how much you borrow. Interest rates were going to stay low. That's not the world we're in any longer. And I think that we still, not in the United States, the UK essentially got, their comeuppance. We haven't had it in the United States yet. We still do not have a Congress or an administration that has changed its orientation on fiscal policy to understanding that the room to maneuver for the staggering, you know, the ability to borrow these staggering amounts of money is just not going to be there. Yep. And you talk to anybody in the markets, and one of the things that they're worried about most is the fact that the machinery, the nature, the way bonds trade from day to day is just not working very well. And it's kind of scary. That's like a $23 trillion market. People like to say the most important price on the planet is the 10-year treasury bond yield. Yeah. And the mechanism that yields us that price is just not working very well.
Right.
So the interaction between, I think, inappropriate fiscal policy and the mechanical problems going on in the markets are going to be something we're really going to want to keep an eye on in the next year.
Yeah. And that's an awesome overlap between supervisory responsibilities and regulatory advisory responsibilities, monetary policy, the fiscal side, a huge overlap, which summarizes nicely our year. Okay. Well, let's wrap it there. Yeah. Greg is on Twitter @Greg_Ip. I am @Caleb Nygaard. Greg, thanks so much for joining me today.
Hey, great conversation. Thanks for having me, Caleb.